This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The structural deficit for Unit 5 schools is $12.5 million and rising $1 to $2 million a year.
You know, my first year here, I would have hoped to have been able to tackle that a little bit more, but we had that funny thing called COVID.
Unit 5 Superintendent Kristen Weichel hopes to have deficit reduction plans in place by the fall. Plus, the town of Normal will rework zoning rules to allow permanent outdoor on-street dining. It proved popular during the pandemic. The Prairie State doesn't have a lot of prairie left. Learn more during WGLT's gardening podcast Grow, and Opera Under the Stars comes to an outdoor venue in Normal. All that and a news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on WGLT. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Let's run down some of the day's top stories. U.S. Senator Dick Durbin says he thinks there is still a chance to pass voting rights legislation before the 2022 midterm elections. He concedes the odds are slim. Durbin says he believes there is now an agreement on a legislative path forward on voting rights legislation within the Democratic caucus, but there's no such accord with the other side of the aisle for the People Act.
We still have a filibuster, and a filibuster means we need 60 votes. We have 50 Democrats. I don't know of any Republican support for ending this corruption or making voting easier.
Durbin says he doesn't know if there would be enough Democratic support to exercise the so-called nuclear option and end the filibuster, even if just for this particular voting rights effort. A week after most Normal town council members publicly backed the professionalism and ethics of city manager Pam Reese, the council will consider giving her two retroactive pay raises. The lump sum in back pay would be about $6,900. Reese made a little over $190,000 in 2019 when the council last renewed her contract. The proposal would give her a raise for 2020 and another one effective in April of this year. Mayor Chris Kuss says the budget uncertainties of the pandemic prompted the council to hold off on the annual compensation decision. The pay raise for 2020 would be 2.9%, and the increase for this year would be 2.4%. County clerks throughout downstate Illinois say they oppose a bill that would allow non-citizens to vote in school board elections. The measure comes in the wake of the approval of bills to create an elected school board for Chicago. Under Senate Bill 1565, non-citizens could provide an affidavit to vote in school board elections, provided they meet residency and parenting requirements. OSF Healthcare is raising its minimum wage to $15 an hour starting in September. OSF's lowest paid employees currently make $12 an hour, a dollar more than the state minimum wage. This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 FM WGLT and WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Support for WGLT comes from Bloomington Normal Audiology. BNA's Hear My Story series continues with local patient Steve Peterson.
The first thing that got me was the crinkling of tinfoil. Seriously, it was extremely loud, hearing stuff I hadn't heard in years.
Steve's full story can be found at bnaudiology.com.
You're listening to Bloomington Normal's Public Media. The town of Normal continues to emerge from the pandemic. Here with an update on Phase 5 progress and other issues is City Manager Pam Reese. Reese says some adjustments have yet to be made.
There are still some restrictions. Children's Museum, Normal Public Library have some restrictions. They're going to be following specifically what schools do regarding the children and their population. But for the most part, I think what we're experiencing is residents seem to be eager to get back out and be active again, participate in programs. Our pools, both Fairview and the Anderson Aquatic Centers, are open and popular.
How is attendance going?
It's weather driven.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's going very well. We're able to fully open with no restrictions at the aquatic centers. So with this heat that's popular, we understand that, and we're glad to have people back at the facility.
Because of Phase 5, the outdoor dining ordinance expired along with the governor's executive order, and the town council is going to consider extending that through the end of the year until new and more permanent rules for outdoor dining, which has proved popular during the pandemic, can be studied and codified. What are some of the things that you'll be looking at as you move toward the end of the year and creating a permanent ordinance on this issue?
We already, a couple years ago, council had adapted outdoor dining through a parklet program for the Uptown area. Stave was the first Uptown business to have a parklet. They were our pilot program. So we already have adapted regulations for outdoor dining in the street area of Uptown. What we need to do is, following COVID, is assess how can we continue to support outdoor dining opportunities elsewhere. And we have a number of restaurants that have adapted and been very creative. Some installed tents and the like, but on many occasions, those seating areas required parking spaces. And so we need to determine what regulations need to be modified in order to allow that to occur in the future. And in most instances, it's going to be an assessment of our required parking spaces and what does that look like. So we just want to make sure we give restaurateurs adequate time to adapt to whatever the regulations may be in 2022.
Are there going to be winners and losers just simply because of a favorable location that doesn't have the opportunity or may have the opportunity for expanded outdoor dining?
Well, I suppose that could be a risk. I think it would be important for us to engage with affected businesses and get input. That's part of what a zoning code modification process does. It allows for public hearing and allows us time to gather input and feedback and see if we can appropriately develop regulations that can generally work for most, if not all, hopefully.
The town of Normal has created a new community engagement plan. Would you inform the listeners about that a little bit?
It's not a formal plan that we've adapted quite yet, but we are putting together a community engagement process and a plan that we want to share with council. We feel like on occasion, we may do a pretty good job of pushing information out, but we find out after the fact we missed the mark. So we're trying to figure out how best can we engage residents, get information to residents, and gather information back. Just this week, we rolled out a new tool to try to better assess the usability and the functionality of our website. And so we have rolled out Chatbot Hugh, H-U-G-H. So those that access our website can rather efficiently enter into a chat text area their question. And the chatbot that we are using is driven by artificial intelligence. So the more questions it receives, the more we can track what do people want to know, is the information readily available, and then the chatbot does a better job as time goes along in terms of directing people to the right location on the website. Additionally, we are working on some website updates, which in and of itself don't sound particularly glamorous or exciting, but the purpose of our website updates doesn't meet accessibility standards. Can all of our residents understand it and access it, see it adequately? So we're doing a redesign of some of our website to accommodate more of an ADA need.
How long before the ADA elements of the redesign will be in place?
I believe that we're going to be seeing that in place by the end of the summer. It's in process right now. But in terms of an overall community engagement plan, that is something that I would like to be sharing with council also this summer.
Normal City Manager Pam Reese says the town is also piloting a Facebook Live series of programs called What's Normal Live. The name comes from the existing town podcast. The City of Bloomington and Town of Normal say 4th of July fireworks celebrations will happen this year, as they do in a non-pandemic year. Reese says the fireworks at Fairview Park will be preceded by a concert and food vendors as the town and state continue to open up. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. It has been a loud week for Unit 5 school board members as conservative activists used the school board meeting to advance their national agenda against certain kinds of Black history education that are not taught in Bloomington Normal. Opposition to that position also showed up. In this interview, Unit 5 Superintendent Kristen Weichel responds to the question of what it's like to be a political football in the nation's culture wars.
You know, as a public school system, we listen to, you know, a number of parents, community members, and groups with, you know, really sometimes differing opinions, and that's okay. Our job is to listen, take that information into consideration, while also considering, you know, rules or guidance from the State Board of Education when making decisions.
Does furor over what you're teaching make your job more difficult?
I wouldn't say that part makes it more difficult. I would always encourage, you know, parents, community members, if they have questions, if we're teaching something, to reach out and ask. And then if they have a concern with it, like let's engage in a conversation so maybe both of us can seek to get more information and learn from one another.
Could the various constituencies who gave the school board their opinion this week have done a better job in a more civil fashion registering their beliefs?
You know, I mean, the meeting, definitely we had some passionate speakers, but I felt like on the whole, you know, everyone was really pretty respectful and civil and overall appropriate.
The district, as a matter of form, passed a budget of just over $203 million. It was a surplus budget of about $3.5 million. It was originally expected to be a $3 million deficit, but there's still a structural deficit of $12.5 million. The structural deficit has been in place for years. When will that be addressed and brought to zero?
I wish I could say it will be, you know, zero in a matter of a year or two, but I can't say that with certainty yet. So what we are doing is, you know, over the years we've been doing some work to have a savings cost with our energy. Right now we're currently really evaluating where all of our expenditures needs that we need to have versus wants. And then really looking at what are additional ways that we can either save additional money or bring in more revenue. You know, my first year here, I would have hoped to have been able to tackle that a little bit more, but we had that funny thing called COVID. That's where most of my efforts were. So we're really just starting to take a deeper dive.
When will you decide how to decide on a package of cuts and revenue enhancements and changes to create efficiencies?
So I would hope by the fall we would have some plans in place that we could present to the board.
How fast is the structural deficit widening?
You know, if we were to do nothing, you would obviously see some sort of increase from last fiscal year to this upcoming fiscal year, just because you have inflation, you know, insurance rates increase, that sort of thing.
On the order of $1 million a year, $2 million a year?
It would be approximately $1.5 million to $2 million.
So you're right now at about 5% of the total budget, and in 5 years you'll be at roughly 10% of the total budget then, right?
Potentially. You know, again, we, our operations and maintenance department, they do an amazing job looking at ways to increase our savings as far as energy and reducing rates. And so we have seen a lot of savings in that regard. Being a school district, though, a lot of our educational funds expenditures come from people because we instruct kids. That's the business that we're in. So that means, you know, teachers, paraprofessionals, administrative assistants, principals, you know, all of the people that it takes to run a school. And that's where the bulk of our education fund expenses come from. So we have to look at, you know, what are our needs based on enrollment, and then what are the desires and priorities for our community.
Let's move on to our old friend, the pandemic. You're getting some hindsight. Does the district feel it did enough to help special needs students during COVID, now that you're coming out on the other side and beginning to look at how things will be in the fall?
You know, I think we did the best that we could at the time with the information that we had in the fall, you know, surrounding COVID. It's really easy to look back and say, oh gosh, we wish we would have done this. But in August and September, you know, COVID was still relatively new, and we were learning new information about it. It seemed like almost on a daily rate. And so I do think we did the best that we could. We have avenues in place that should we need to make up some education for students with IEPs, and they qualify for that makeup of education, that we have ways that we can do that. So that really is handled on an individual student basis.
There is at least one parent who has told us that special needs students' rights were violated by not giving them the instruction they're required to provide, at least early on in the pandemic, and that this parent's son made dramatic improvements after schools reopened, so that there was an opportunity lost there. What do you tell that parent?
You know, I would venture to say that most of our students do learn better in person. And I was a special education teacher myself, and so I know it can be a challenge for some students with special needs to learn through a computer. For some of our students, it was probably the first time that they ever, you know, tried to learn and receive instruction that way. And so, you know, I know our teachers worked hard to provide materials and instruction that was meaningful to the individual students that they served, whether it be through a computer or, you know, we had a number of staff even delivering work activities to students' home just to make sure that they were meeting their individual needs.
That's Unit 5 School District Superintendent Kristen Weichel. This is 89.1 FM WGLT and WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Illinois is known as the Prairie State, but just how much prairie is actually left? On this week's episode of WGLT's gardening podcast, Grow, hosts Sarah Nardi and Patrick Murphy talk with Jessica Chambers of the ISU Horticulture Center. Chambers says at one time about 60% of Illinois was covered in prairies, totaling around 22 million acres. That is no longer the case.
What we have left of true Illinois remnant prairie is about a little less than 2,500 acres.
Oh, wow.
So most of our prairie is gone. Here in McLean County, the best place to see a remnant prairie would be out at Weston Cemetery out on Highway 24, right after Shenoa, Weston, and then you see the only remaining 4 acres of true prairie in this county.
Okay, so when this is, I think, a thing from my childhood. Driving up to Chicago, you know, you're on 55 for 2 hours, and you just look out your window and you see green, wide, unbroken expanse. And I always thought, I live in the prairie. But that's not what I'm looking at, correct?
Well, you're probably looking at either cornfields yeah. or soybean fields is what you're looking at. On 55 up towards Chicago, you do go by a sign that says Madewin Tall Grass Prairie.
Okay.
That would be a cool place. I haven't gone there yet, but that would be a cool place to pull over. But I mean, a true prairie, like, yeah, they're mostly gone. Now, there's places all over Illinois that there are people hard at work reestablishing prairies.
Mm-hmm.
So it's as sad as it is, and I really think it is a tragedy. I think the prairies must have been as grand as the Grand Canyon is
sure.
grand. And I think it's vital that we save those last, you know, 2,500 acres. But there are also people all over the state that are working really hard to revitalize or, you know, save or reintroduce prairies.
And Patrick, I know you have strong feelings about this, right? Like the reintroduction of indigenous plants.
Well, I think it's interesting. And I did not know that a lot of forestation took place where there was once a prairie. So a good intention had an unintended outcome. I thought it was interesting too, because there's a tree shortage. Mm-hmm. At the same time, people are planting more trees per capita than they have ever in history. And perhaps that's related to why we're seeing stubble field. Like you mentioned, when you drive up 55, northern Illinois, you see all these areas that look like prairie, but it's actually farmland that has not been cultivated for a while, and stubble field has regrown there.
So in our good faith efforts to repopulate the land with trees, have we inadvertently damaged prairies? Should we be concentrating on planting prairie grass instead of planting a tree next Earth Day?
Well, my understanding of that is it's easier to plant a tree than it is to create a prairie.
Mm.
Creating a prairie takes like 3 or 4 years minimum from the initial improvement of the ground, sowing of the seed, and a couple of mowings to keep the broadleaf weeds down and to allow the root horizon of the desirables to build up so that they can overtake the broadleaf weeds.
I think what's important there, too, is also to consider what was it.
Mm-hmm.
If this area would have been, you know, prairie, then to me, that's what should go back. You know, if this is a wooded area that, you know, originally had, you know, Illinois hardwoods or it was an Illinois savanna, then that's what should go back.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would say that for Earth Day next year and Arbor Day, I'm leaning more towards focusing on the prairie.
So it sounds like maybe we just have a little bit of a messaging problem around prairies.
I definitely think it's education.
Yeah.
Maybe we were taught a little bit about Loringals wilder and red louse on the prairie.
Mm-hmm.
But I definitely don't think that as Illinoisans, we have a great appreciation for our prairie. And it's beautiful. And, you know, you hear people poo-poo Illinois for many different reasons. Every state's got its issues.
Of course.
But this is a beautiful state. And I think if you're here in central Illinois, then go see it. Just go try and understand a little bit. Every time you go see a different prairie, the experience is going to be different.
Find full episodes of Grow online at WGLT.org or wherever you get your podcasts. This is Sound Ideas. Musical theater fans are no doubt eager for the return of live performances this fall. Meanwhile, Prairie Fire Theater Artistic Director Bob Mangiolardi suggests Bloomington Normal residents give opera a try. Arts correspondent Brianna Groh talks with Mangiolardi and soprano Grace Henderson about opera Under the Stars coming to the Connie Link Amphitheater in Normal at 7:30 p.m. June 29th and 30th.
Prairie Fire Theater performs both music theater and opera, but Mangiolardi knows that for general audiences, especially in Bloomington Normal, opera is a harder sell.
Our community seems to like opera, but certainly not like it likes music theater.
So, for the group's first live performance in nearly 2 years, Mangiolardi has assembled a widely palatable lineup of pieces from Mozart to Bernstein.
So we don't have a lot of real esoteric pieces or super, super heavy pieces or obscure pieces. We wanted things that probably they would know. They may not know everything, but they'll know a lot of them. And we've got a few pieces we want the audience to sing along with us.
Soprano Grace Henderson will be performing selections from Die Fledermaus by Johann Strauss II. She says the piece Adele's Laughing Song is a good example of the lighter side of opera.
So she is actually a housemaid, and she is at a party pretending to be an actress with a bunch of people who also are portraying people they are not. It's called Adele's Laughing Song because she just laughs her way through the song, which I love because I spend most of my days laughing. So it's appropriate for me to sing, I think.
Mozart may seem highbrow, but Henderson insists the pieces Mangiolardi has selected have all the fun and energy of a Broadway show.
They're entertaining, just like musical theater is upbeat and has a lot of movement to it. These pieces have that as well, but just in a different style.
For Henderson, you really can't appreciate one without appreciating the other.
Really, even the history of musical theater is opera. So I love history, so I love exploring these composers like Strauss and Mozart and composers that whose music has stood the test of time all over the world. And also these more contemporary composers, Bernstein, and they came out of the music of opera. Those are their roots. That's their inspiration. And so I think it's really important to dive into that.
That's all good and well for music buffs like Henderson. But what about younger audiences? Henderson's own performing arts career proves it's never too early to get acquainted with the classics.
My very first show I was ever in, I was 3 years old, and it was Babes in Toyland with Prairie Fire Theater. And it was kind of my first exposure to professional theater.
After studying vocal performance at Grand Canyon University in Phoenix, Henderson now teaches vocal performance in Bloomington Normal. In fact, she says she'll be telling all of her students, ranging in age from 6 to 14 years old, to attend the show.
I think it is wonderful for children to be exposed at a young age to the arts. And the more exposure they get to that at a young age, the more familiar they are with it, the more they'll like it and enjoy it.
Mangiolardi says the new venue makes it a little easier to bring the kids along, too.
This thing is you can just come out to the County Link Auditorium and sit there, get bring a blanket, bring something to drink and eat, and it's like a little mini Ravinia, you know?
The choice to make the theater's post-lockdown debut at the County Link Amphitheater was one of necessity, but could lead to other opportunities, Mangialardi says.
We didn't know exactly when we were planning this, where we would be in terms of cases and all of that, so we just had a safe way to do this. Would be to do it outside. But if it's successful and people seem to like it and the performers like it, I think the Town of Normal might have us come back and do it again.
Prairie Fire Theater brings Opera Under the Stars to the Connie Link Amphitheater at 7:30 p.m. June 29th and 30th. I'm Brianna Groh.
Both performances of Prairie Fire Theater's Opera Under the Stars are free, though donations are welcome to support the theater. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT, made possible in part by Bloomington Normal Audiology. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is Bloomington Normal's Public Media.